All right, good morning, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started. It is 9 o'clock, according to my cell phone, so that's official Greenwich Mean Time. So we're gonna go with that. We're not quite ready yet to start the class on the King James Bible. That's going to start next week. This week, we had a spot that was untaken, mostly because I didn't schedule anybody for Labor Day weekend, another teacher, because I kind of figured most people would see Labor Day weekend and say, "Oh, I think I'm going to be gone." So I'm gonna bring a lesson this morning. If you would open up to Colossians chapter 1. So what I'm going to talk about this morning is something I've been wanting to talk about for a while. I've talked about it in bits and pieces in many different settings, and I continue to get questions about this material. In private messages on Facebook, and also through emails that people have sent the church and other things. And so I've had it in my mind for a while to teach a whole lesson on how conditions work. Now, obviously, you know that there's been somewhat of a controversy regarding Romans 8:17 and the conditions, that conditional statements there, and my involvement in that led me into a consideration of these things. And when I first taught this stuff, both in the paper and also last year here at the church, I taught them relying pretty heavily on using some Greek to do that. Now, I don't necessarily apologize for that. I don't think that anything I said was wrong. I don't think anybody that has taken exception with anything that I've said has proved that anything I said was wrong. But I also have since looked at some of these things with respect to English and want to kind of go over some things that I think are pretty critical to understanding some of how these conditions work. Folks, if you don't understand the conditions properly, you're running the risk of really misunderstanding and therefore misapplying a lot of things from the Scripture. And so what I want to do is look at this. Now, what I think I'm going to do, I've got papers spread all over here, because I don't have one hard set of notes. I'm kind of drawing here from four or five different things that I've done in pieces in other places. So what I want to do is talk about this. Look at Colossians chapter 3. Now, I'm going to intentionally try to stay away from talking about this within the context of the verses that are creating some controversy. We'll touch on them shortly in one spot. But I want to kind of not look at those on purpose, because I want this to be about understanding how the conditions work more so than trying to answer any particular position or teaching on any specific verse. So look at Colossians chapter 3, verse 1. It says, "If ye then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth at the right hand of God." Now, if you look at that verse, how do you understand that if? Okay? Is he saying, maybe you're risen with Christ and maybe you're not? Or is he saying, on the basis of the fact that you are risen with Christ, seek those things which are above? Okay? Now, I think it's pretty clear, it should be pretty clear for most people that can the word if mean something different depending on how it's being used? Okay? Now, Just to clarify that, go quickly back to chapter 2. Go back to chapter 2 of Colossians and start at verse 10. He says, "And ye are complete in him which is the head of all principality and power, in whom also ye are circumcised with a circumcision made without hands, and the putting off of the body of sins of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ." Now look at verse 12. "Buried with him by baptism, wherein also ye are" what? "Risen with him through the faith of the operation of God who raised him from the dead." Does chapter 2, verse 12 state as a fact that the believer is risen with Christ? So when you come to chapter 3, verse 1, and it says, "If ye then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above," is he now all of a sudden questioning whether or not the believer is risen with Christ or not? Well, obviously he's not, right? So every conditional statement, okay, contains two parts. Now, what I have here on the top, the protasis, this is a word of English grammar. Okay? the antecedents, this is a word of logic and philosophy. But they're referring to the same thing. Okay? The apodus is also a word of English grammar. Meanwhile, the consequence, in parentheses, is a word of logic and philosophy, right? So every conditional statement has a prothesis, and the prothesis contains the if statement, or the antecedent, and the apodus contains the consequent, or the main result of the condition up here in the prothesis. Now, before we go any further, does everybody understand that? Okay, so here, this statement contains, let me read you the definitions. This is from the Oxford English Dictionary. First, the definition of if. This is the English definition of if. It says, introducing a clause of condition or supposition, the prothesis of a conditional sentence. That's the dictionary definition. So if for Colossians 3, verse 1, that would be this statement right here. That's the prothesis. Okay? It contains the word what? If. Right? The dictionary goes on to say, so let me read that again. Introducing a clause of condition or supposition, the prothesis of a conditional sentence. On condition that, given or granted that, in the case that, supposing that, or on supposition that. So every conditional statement has a prothesis and an apodus. Okay? And again, those are words of English grammar. These two words are words of logic and philosophy, antecedent and consequent. So every conditional statement has this. The dictionary definition of prothesis. Where'd it go? Oh, here it is. A stretching forward a proposition, the major premise of a hypothetical clause, which would be what?
Yeah.
If. Right? So that's this portion of the conditional statement, right? The definition of the apodus is the concluding clause of a sentence as constructed with the introductory clause or prothesis, now usually restricted to the consequent clause in a conditional sentence. Okay? Now, I understand this is a lot of, I'm not trying to be overly technical here, but we sort of have to be somewhat technical if we're going to define these things properly. So, in other words, this part of the verse here is the consequence of what? This. So, if ye then be risen with Christ, is he saying, maybe you're risen, maybe you're not? I think we all agree that that's not what he's saying, right? So, on the basis of the established fact that you're risen with Christ, what's the consequence? Seek those things which are where? Above, right? So this first part contains the condition, and in grammar it's known as the prothesis. This part is the consequent, and that's why I've got these two words in here, because you might be more familiar with them. So in other words, because this, then what? Then this. All right, any questions about any of that so far? A statement like this, folks, is what we call modus ponens logic. Now, okay, I understand. I'm giving you the big words here, okay? Modus ponens logic. It's basically if P, then what? Q. So this would be what? That's P. This is what? Q. So if you then be risen with Christ, if some such thing, then what? Seek those things which are above, right? So this is basic modus ponens, if P then Q. It gets its name from a Latin word which means the way of affirmation. So, and I've summarized it here for you. If some such thing, then what? Some such thing. So if ye then be risen with Christ, then what? Seek those things which are above. So that's the basic structure of this, okay? In logic, you'll see this referred to as affirming the antecedent. Okay? Because here's the antecedent, here's what the consequence of that antecedent is. Everybody with me?
Yeah.
Amen. Praise Jesus. Okay. Now, I want to stop there for a minute, and I want to go back and just touch on something that I've already taught you before. Okay? That is, and when we looked at these things in the past, as I said, we looked at them with respect to Greek. Okay, Greek grammarians identify four different types of conditions. Alright? The first one is called a first class condition. And the first class condition, is identified as the condition followed by a verb in the indicative mood. Okay, now, do we have a condition here? Where's the next verb after the condition? Right there, be risen. That verb is in what mood? The indicative mood. Okay? This is what we call in English grammar, therefore, an indicative conditional statement. In logic, it's referred to as, in philosophy and logic, it's referred to as a hypothetical syllogism. Okay? Now let me read to you what that means. A hypothetical syllogism is a construct of a conditional major premise and an unconditional minor premise leading to an unconditional conclusion. In other words, even though one of the premises is hypothetical, the conclusion is not. So when you read this statement, is Paul saying, maybe you should seek those things which are above?
No.
No, he's saying on the basis of this, you should what? That's the consequence. Okay? So the first type of condition that Greek grammarians identify is exactly that kind right there. A first-class condition is identified as the condition followed by a verb in the indicative mood. A second class, and so we could think of that as equaling if and it's true. Okay? Now, come with me if you would to Luke 7. The second type of condition, so we got that's first class. Second class would be in the form of if followed by the imperfect tense. And or sometimes also the indicative mood would apply here. But they call this the second class condition. Look at Luke 7:39. Look at Luke 7:39. Now when the Pharisees which had bidden him saw it, he spake within himself, saying, this man, if he were a prophet, would have known who and what manner of woman this is that toucheth him, for she is a sinner. When the Pharisee says, this man, if he were a prophet, would have known who and what manner of woman this is that toucheth her, is he saying, what is the function here of the condition? The function, yeah, it's more.
The other way around.
It's more if it's true, but it's what? But it's not. So in other words, if he were a prophet, he should have what? So is the guy questioning whether or not he's really a prophet?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that clearly a different function than this if over here?
Yeah.
It's obviously a different usage of the word if. Let's look at one more in this category. Come over to, there's a bunch of them we could look at. Come over to John chapter 11. Come over to John chapter 11 and look at verse 32. John chapter 11, verse 32. Then Mary was come where Jesus was and saw him. And she fell down at his feet saying, Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. What's she saying?
You weren't here, so my brother died.
You weren't here, so my brother died, right? So, in other words, if you were here, it would be true that he was. That he wouldn't have died, but the fact is he was. He did die. Everybody with that? Okay? Then you have, they'll also identify a third class. Okay? This is the condition if, followed by the subjunctive mood. Now, this is not subjective mood. You type in the word subjunctive in the Word, Microsoft Word, and it automatically wants to switch it to subjective. It's not subjective. Okay? Come with me to Romans 7. Romans chapter 7. Verse 2. Romans chapter 7, verse 2. Okay? It says, "For the woman which hath an husband is bound by law to her husband so long as he liveth. But if the husband be dead, she is loosed from the law of her husband." Where's the condition? If the husband be what? Okay? So, the wife's being bound to the law of her husband is subject to what? Whether he's alive or whether he's dead, right? So if the husband is alive, is the wife subject to the law of the husband? The only way the wife is loose from the law of the husband is if the husband's what? Dead, right? So it's subjunctive. In other words, it's look, the root word here is the word subject, right? It is subject to the circumstances. As long as the husband is alive, is the wife bound to the husband? Shake your head, yes, right? If the husband's dead, is the wife loose from the law of the husband? So clearly, is that the concept Paul is meaning to convey in Colossians 3:1? Is Paul saying, well, if you have your risen with Christ, not really sure if you are, we need to wait and see if you are, see if those things which are above. Is that what he's saying? No, right? So the third class, that the this one is summarized by maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Everybody understand what I'm... Everybody with that? Mm-hmm. Okay. Come with me if you would to Acts 17. There's a fourth class that is recognized, and this is if followed by what's known in Greek, the operative, move. Now, I'll have more to say about some of this in a minute, but Acts 17, start at verse 26. The verse I want is 27, but let's read verse 26 first. He says, Acts 17:26, "And hath made of one blood all nations of men, for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation." Now watch verse 27. "That they should seek the Lord," what's the next word? If what? Haply they might feel after him and find him. Now, is he saying there that they will, for sure, on the basis of an established fact, seek after the Lord and feel after him? No. I'm grabbing my phone for a reason. I have the definition here of the English word. Well, I did. Just give me one moment. Haply. That's basically what it means. Haply, by chance, perhaps it may be so. And then, by accident or by complete coincidence. So when he says, if, what did I do with my ear? When he says there, if haply they might feel after him, is he saying they definitely will? Is he saying, if it's true, but it's not? It's even stronger than that, right? It's even stronger than maybe it is, maybe it isn't. What it's the equivalent of is saying, maybe it's true, but it probably what?
Probably.
It probably isn't, right? Do we know from Romans chapter 3 that no man seeketh after God? Right? So has God left a situation where if happily by coincidence or chance somebody seeks after God, that God has left himself a witness in creation and other things? Yes. So, this would be then, as I just said, maybe it's true,
Why I can't spell them.
Sorry. Alright. So these are the four types of conditions that that the Greek grammarians will discuss, right? And they're all functioning based upon the relationship between the conditional statement and the mood on the verb following the condition. Okay? Now, are there any questions about any of that? I will say this. The two most common are this one and this one. The two most common conditions that you're going to run into are the first class and the third class. Yeah, Mike.
Well, then, how is the English reader supposed to determine?
I'm glad you asked that, because that's where I'm going to get into next.
Segue
into where I want to go next. So, this is material that I taught previous. When we went through 2 Timothy chapter 2, remember we went through 2 Timothy chapter 2 and we were studying that faithful saying, and we looked at if we suffer, we shall also reign with him. If we deny him, he also will deny us, and all those things. Remember, I talked to you a lot about the difference between the first and the third class condition. Well, that material that I covered there was criticized in some quarters quite heavily because it was very Greek reliant. And my commitment, if you will, to the King James Bible in English was called into question because I was daring to refer to some Greek to make a couple points. Okay, so further study on my part has revealed something quite significant, and that is, in English, the conditions work exactly the same as they do in Greek. Okay, they work exactly the same in English as they do in Greek. So with all that as a backdrop, let me read to you further from the Oxford English Dictionary. Okay? So,
what does the context indicate, though? Seems to me context is pretty powerful, too.
I agree. Yeah. So this is, again, this is the Oxford English Dictionary entry on the word if. It says, this is the dictionary. It's not me. It's the English Dictionary. With the conditional clause or prothesis in the indicative. The indicative after if implies that the speaker expresses no adverse opinion as to the truth of the statement in the clause and is consistent with his acceptance of it. What does that mean? That's the same thing as saying what?
If it is true.
So when Paul says here, if he then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, is he saying, maybe it is, maybe it isn't? Is he saying, if it's true, but maybe it's not? Is he saying, maybe it's true, but it probably isn't? Or is he saying, if and it's true? And it's followed by what? It's followed by indicative. And when you read that in English, is that not the obvious meaning of what that should tell you? Seems to me that it is, right? Going on with this, so then I get the Oxford English Dictionary and I look up the word indicative. Okay? This is what it says. It says here, in grammar, the indicative points out, states, or declares, applied to the mood of a verb of which the essential function is to state a relation of objective fact between the subject and the predicate, as opposed to a relation merely conceived, thought of, or wished by the speaker. It goes on to say that the indicative is the form of the statement. Having the verb in the indicative mood is assertive of objective fact. What does that mean? It means what? If and it's true. So the English dictionary is telling you that any time that you have the English condition if followed by the indicative mood attached to that condition, what is the function of that condition? Is that function of that condition to call anything into question or to state the objective connection between the two things? It's saying, if P, then what? Then Q. Therefore, it's in English grammar, an indicative conditional what? There's a reason why it's called that in English grammar, because of the function of the indicative even in the English. Is everybody following that? So, let's go back to the dictionary definition of if. With the conditional clause or prothesis in the subjunctive, and the principal clause or apodous, the subjunctive after if implies that the speaker guards himself from endorsing the truth or realization of the statement, and it is consistent with his doubt of it. What's that? That's maybe it is, maybe it isn't, right? So go back to Romans 7, verse 2. Is Paul stating as the objective fact that the wife is loose from the law of the husband? No, he's not, because he doesn't know if the husband is still what? Alive or not. If the husband is still alive, is the wife bound to the law of the husband? If the husband is dead, is she loose from the law of the husband? But it's completely contingent on what? Or subject to what? Whether or not the husband is alive or what. So in that case, the satisfaction of the condition is up in the air because it is not yet determined. The circumstances are not yet what? Everybody understand what I'm saying? So in English, does the subjunctive serve the same function after if that it does in Greek? According to the English dictionary, the answer is what?
Yes.
Now let me read you the definition of subjunctive. Let me show you this too. So this is the English dictionary with both prothesis.
Again, that would be that statement, not for this specific statement, but that first part. With both prothesis and apodous, in the subjunctive, the expression means to express a hypothesis which is admittedly not true or realized, and stating what would be the logical or not natural consequences of its truth or realization. So if you have a double subjunctive in English, now it's saying what? It's not what? It's not true. It's not the case. So, again, folks, these are all working, these English conditions are working the same. Let me read you the English definition of subjunctive. Subjunctive, that is subjoined or dependent. Subjunctive article is grammatical term was used variously with its meaning subjoined. Okay, here it is. Designating a mood, the forms of which are employed to denote an action or a state as conceived and not as fact. Therefore used to express a wish, command, exhortation, or a contingent, hypothetical, or prospective event. Okay? So what is the English, looking into how the conditions work in English, what we learned is the conditions in English work virtually the same way they work where? In Greek. Okay? And all you need to do is get an English dictionary to look these words up to figure this out. Right? So what you need to do when you're reading your Bible and you come across a condition, you don't have to go to Blue Letter Bible or some other program and look at the parsing. All you have to do is ask yourself, well, what is the purpose of this? What is this condition trying to convey? Is it trying to convey the absolute objective relationship between two things? Or is there something in some way, shape, manner, or form that is subjunctive, up in the air, or not yet what? Not yet known or determined. If there is, then it cannot be a statement in the form of if and it's true. It has to be a statement in some other type of form, like maybe it is, maybe what? Maybe it isn't. Alright, so any questions about any of that? I hope this is helping. Is this helping or not? Some of you, if it's not, don't tell me now because you'll
Just hurt my feelings, okay? Any questions or comments so far? I don't say that to twist your arm into agreeing with me. This stuff to me seems to be pretty... And with that in mind, that fits what I read you earlier about the function of a hypothetical syllogism. Let me read it to you again. It's a syllogism that are constructed on a conditional major premise and an unconditional minor premise, leading to an unconditional conclusion. In other words, even though one of the premises is hypothetical, the conclusion is not. If I say to my sons, if you're my son, then act like it. Am I saying, oh, geez, I'm not sure if you're my son?
I might not say that.
Maybe I shouldn't say that, but you get the point, right? I'm not saying, when I say if you're my son, then act like it, I'm not saying maybe you're my son, maybe you're not. I'm not calling that into question. Am I saying on the basis of the fact that you're my son, then what? Then act like it, right? Come with me, go over now, if you would, to Romans 8. So I think I've covered all that. Now look at verse 17. And if children, then what?
Heirs.
What kind of statement is that?
Is that
a bonus statement? If he, then what? If children, then what?
Heirs,
right? Well, is he saying maybe you're a child, maybe you're not? Well, how do you know he's not saying that? What verse 4 say? Verse 16 said that the Spirit bears witness with our spirit that we are what? Okay? So when he gets to verse 17, he says, and if children, then heirs, he's not now all of a sudden saying, I'm not sure. Maybe you're a child, maybe you're not. Is that what he's saying?
No,
he's saying on the basis of the fact that you're what?
A child.
If some such thing, then you're what? Then you're Q, what? Heirs. Everybody see that? Okay? So is that a statement of if and it's true, or maybe it is, maybe it isn't? Okay? Everybody with that?
Sometimes it's easier just to substitute another word for it. For example, since I own.
You can't do that, Mike.
Since it is true.
Well, listen, you can't. If you do that, you're undermining. You're changing the King James Bible. You can't do that. Now I'm being facetious with you to make a point.
English changes over the years.
But that's where some people are at with this, right? That they're, if you even suggest, for example, later on that if so be could mean carries the force of the English word since. Well, now you're undermining the King James Bible, right? I understand what you're saying, but. The translators, I do believe that the translators rendered these words if for a reason. And I believe that the reason they did it this way is so that to force you to follow the logic of the statements of the argument that he's making. Okay, now let's look at the other one. And if children, then heirs. That one's easy, right? That one's easy. That's clearly a statement of logical fact, right? Based upon the previous verse. So then you go on and it says, and heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. So when it says there, look at verse 17, and if children then heirs, semicolon, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ, what that middle part is doing is just elaborating on what kind of an heir you are. Right? If you're an heir, well, what kind of an heir am I? I'm an heir of God and a joint heir with who? Christ, semicolon, if so be that we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together. Okay? So let's talk for a minute about if so be. I've heard it said in the not too distant past by a particular Bible teacher. He said the following about if so be. He said that if so be means, if it be so, if the condition exists, then it's true. Let's say I take that interpretation. What does if so be mean then?
If you don't suffer, you don't be glorified.
Let me read it again. If it be so, if this condition exists, then it's true. Okay. That said, that says, if so be that we suffer with him, that we might what? What kind of statement is that again? That's another hypothetical what? That's another statement of basic logic, right? If so be that we suffer P, then, let me make sure I don't mess it up. If so be that we suffer with him, that we may also be what? See, if you don't understand that as a statement of fact, now you're calling into question whether or not you're going to be glorified with him. Aren't you? Okay? So let's talk about this. If I look at that statement, if so be that we suffer, where is the first verb after if so be?
Suffer.
What mood is it in, do you think? Just read the statement.
I missed that when you were talking.
If so be that we suffer, that we may also be glorified together.
We suffer as present tense with God.
It's if and it's what? Now, if I say now, well, see, if what I have to do now is to maintain a particular theological position, is to then say, well, this phraseology has to mean the same thing every time. You think that's a good idea or not a good idea? What's that? It's not a good idea. Okay, come with me if you would to Matthew. And let me just look up here quick on my phone the exact verse I had, because I didn't write it down. Matthew 18. Matthew 18, start at verse 11. For the Son of Man is come to save that which is lost. Who's that? Who's the Son of Man?
Christ,
right? Verse 12. How think ye, if a man have 100 sheep, and one of them be gone astray, doth he not leave the 99, and goeth into the mountains, and seeketh that one which is gone astray? Okay, so understand. There's 100 sheep, how many of them go astray?
One.
Is he going to leave the 99 and go look for the one?
Yes.
Okay, look at the next verse. And if so be that he find it, verily I say unto you, he rejoiceth more of that sheep than of the 99 which went not astray. What is the meaning of if so be in that verse? If so be that he what? So, maybe he'll find it and maybe he what? Won't. And whether or not he rejoices is going to be contingent upon whether or not he what? Finds it. So would it be a mistake to say that if so be, that phraseology means the same thing every time it's in the Bible? That would be a mistake, right? Because in this case, guess what the mood is? And you can see that in English because he's only going to rejoice if he finds what? If he finds the sheep. If he doesn't find the sheep, he won't what?
Rejoice.
Because it's contingent upon, it's subject to the circumstances. If the sheep is found, he'll rejoice. If the sheep's not found, he what? He won't. So in Romans 8:17, is Paul saying, maybe you suffer with them and maybe you don't. We have to wait and see how it turns out. Is that what he's saying there? No, that's not what he's saying.
But is that what the construct is conveying in that verse? Let me show you another one. Come over to Ephesians 4. So, what I'm saying is, if so be, is a form of a conditional statement, right? Because it has the word what? If. And by the way, let me commit some real sacrilege for you for a moment. In Romans 8:17, the phrase "if so be that" is a translation of the word "epir," the Greek word "epir." In Matthew chapter 8, the phrase "if so be" is a compound word taken from two separate Greek words. Okay, but you're not supposed to look at that because that's undermining. But my point is, it does not help you, it does not help me, in order to try to defend some entrenched position that I have, to paint with a broad brush and say that all these conditions mean the same thing every time they occur. That's just silly, right? Because you just know, not only from what we did see here by looking at these things, and by looking at some Greek stuff, but more importantly from the English dictionary, that there are different conditions that are mean to be expressed by the use of the word what? If. And the function of the condition depends on the mood on the verb that follows what? The condition. Okay? Where did I tell you to go? Ephesians 4. Okay, Ephesians 4. Now, let's go all the way back up to verse 17 in this case. This I say, therefore, and testify in the Lord, that ye henceforth walk not as other Gentiles walk in the vanity of their mind. So, is that the way Paul wants them to walk? No. Verse 18. Having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God through the ignorance that is in them because of the blindness of their heart, who being past feeling have given themselves over unto lasciviousness to work all uncleanness with greediness. Now look at verse 20. But ye have not so what? What does that verse mean? Is verse 17, 18, 19 what Paul taught them about Christ and how they should walk?
No.
So it says, but ye have not so learned. What tense? Past tense, right? So is Paul talking about something that he's already taught them? Okay, now look at the next verse. If so be, now watch, that ye have what?
Heard
him. What tense is that? So have they already heard him in this manner?
Yes.
Read on. And have been what? Taught by him. As the truth is where? Okay? So which way should we read if so be here? Should we read it as in Matthew 18, where maybe he'll rejoice, maybe he won't, in the sense here of maybe they've been taught this, maybe they haven't? Or should we read it in the sense of Romans 8, on the basis of the established fact that I've taught you this, here's how you should walk? Yeah, that one. Is there a difference? There's a difference. Okay? If so be that you've been taught by him, if so be that you have heard him and been taught by him as the truth is in Jesus, that you put off the former conversation of the old man which is corrupt according to the deceitful lusts. So, in this case, the function of the if so be is in line with how it's being used where? In Romans 8. The if so be here is not being used the same way the if so be is being used in Matthew chapter 18. And my point is, when you're considering these conditions, you need to ask yourself, in each individual occurrence, what is the point of this condition? As Lee said, given the context, given what's being discussed in the passage, and how each one of them is structured in a grammatical sense, what does it mean in this particular case? Okay? Go back to Romans 8. Anybody have any questions or comments about any of this? Oh, yeah.
Well, I just think that general 20th century, 21st century Americans are not used to being so precise in their English.
No. Yeah.
And they don't think that precisely, and they don't take words to mean exact things.
Our language is deteriorated.
Yeah.
That's absolutely, I don't know how anybody could deny that. And so your point then is what? That this type of precision in understanding the words is overlooked?
It doesn't come natural to
okay.
Americans.
It just
doesn't.
But we know how to tweet.
we know how to tweet. And unfortunately, the newer translations take the preciseness out so that even if you study, you can't find it.
So let me just comment on that, and then I'll get Mike's question. So look at Romans 8:17. And if children and heirs, heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ, if so be that we suffer with Him. A modern version will take the if so be and translate it indeed. Okay? Now, is indeed... Does the word indeed carry the sense of what that underlying word means? I would say yes, it does. But by changing it to indeed, they're doing exactly what you said. They're taking out the precision. They're doing the hard work for you is what they're doing and not forcing you to what? To think and think about what you're reading and study what you're reading so that you can get to the bottom of it and really get an understanding of it. So... while, yeah, you might be able to read that, and you maybe have a more familiarity with the word indeed or the word since, that it's there is a sense that is sort of cheating you out of a richness of study that you would get if you really looked into this, like we just did. You follow what I'm saying? So I don't know, I hope that makes sense.
But at the time the King James Bible was translated, English was a more pure language.
Absolutely.
And everybody who spoke English, just from having spoken this way their whole life, knew exactly what things meant.
That's also undeniable. Yeah. Mike?
I was just wondering, if we approach it grammatically, is that how we're supposed to approach the King James Bible then? Because the King James is the grammar correct in the King James Bible, or do we ultimately have to go to the Greek to see if the grammar
is I would say that you can, and that's why I'm spending all this time showing you that this stuff works the way it works in English, because I think you can trust what you have in English. I do. I think that if you look at that structure, if so be that we suffer with Him, and you understand that as a statement of as an indicative conditional statement, and I don't have to change it to since or indeed or whatever, then it causes me to really understand what's going on in that verse on a level, I believe, that I would not get if that had been switched out for me. So I don't...
Let me just be clear, Mike. I do not think looking into any of this is wrong. I did it. In the Greek. Okay? But I didn't do it with the intention of correcting this in English. I did it with the intention of trying to gain a better understanding of what I had. Okay? When I was criticized for it, I took it a step further and looked at all this stuff in English and discovered that it works exactly what? The same way. Yeah, Lee.
I had a lot of controversy knowing some of the background for that. Somewhere along the line, there were those who completely rejected the Greek, saying that we correct the Greek from the English.
Yeah, that was Ruckman's position.
That's bad news, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't. That to me, that's a Ruckmanite.
I'm struggling with people who have taught that. That's what they believe. You correct the English, or correct the Greek from the English.
You're absolutely right. Ruckman's got a whole chapter in his book on manuscript evidence about how the English corrects the Greek. And so that's where that idea is coming from. Yeah.
So my assumption is I can trust the King James Bible in its grammar
Yes.
All I need.
Yes.
Yes.
Assuming you know English grammar, you can trust your English Bible.
Amen. Well, what about translations like Wyman, who he says the reason I'm doing my translation is to help you understand the Greek moods and tenses and so forth, because...
Wyman's
translation.
Okay. I've never seen that one.
You know, the purpose of it is to, you know, his translation is to translate the Greek tenses and moods so that the English reader can understand them better.
I think the English reader can understand the English King James Bible just fine if they know English grammar.
If you know English grammar.
But you cannot say that the English grammar doesn't matter. Like some, it's just fascinating to me how some of the same folks that are upset with me for even daring in their mind to even look at anything in Greek will then turn right around and say the English grammar doesn't matter and all these things mean the same thing all the way across the board. It's like, are you serious? I mean, is that really what you want? Is that really your position, or is that just a position that you're adopting to support your, you know, sort of pet doctrinal issue or whatever? As soon as somebody says this is this way all the time, you better question that statement and look into it for yourself. Because it is very rare, sometimes it is, okay, but it is very rarely a certain way every single one, every single time. Because of exactly what Ronnie's talking about, the nuances of the English grammar. Okay, so if I'm looking at, just another example then would be verse 9. No, not verse 9. Verse 9?
Yeah.
Yeah, verse 9. But ye are not in the flesh, but where? Okay? So are the believers at Rome in the flesh or in the spirit? If so be that the Spirit of God dwell in you. Is he saying, maybe the Spirit of God dwells in you or maybe he doesn't? If that's what he's saying, then how can he make the first statement? But ye are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit. How can you not be in the flesh or the Spirit if the Spirit of God doesn't what? Dwell in you. But if you're going to take that if so be, and you're going to say that it means the same thing the one meant over in Matthew 18, you're going to be in real trouble, because what you're going to end up saying in that verse is that, as some have, as we've already seen, that God the Holy Spirit does not necessarily indwell every believer unless they meet whatever they say the conditions are. That is trouble, folks. And you end up in that trouble for precisely not paying attention to the English grammar. Yeah.
Well, just to make it easier for us, though, the Holy Spirit through Paul goes on.
He does. I know where you're going. Go ahead and say it.
Yeah, well, both in verse 9 and back up there with verse 16 also. You know, he just spells it out. And in the suffering verses, for I reckon the sufferings of this present time are not worthy. I mean, if you just keep reading, you can't get a heresy out of it.
And so what you have to do, that's a good way of, yeah, I appreciate you saying it that way. But I mean, when you don't understand the grammar here though, in this statement, and you want to twist it or disregard it or not pay attention to it because you want to say something else, that's where, so Mike, I guess I would say to you that you can, if you can trust the English that you have in your English King James Bible, assuming you know English grammar.
And so these guys that you're criticizing are just avoiding English grammar.
They are.
Philosophically, or
they are. They have stated. They've adopted an absolute statement about this, the meaning of the if so be, and they are unwilling to budge. Because if they budge a little bit and they allow an inkling that they may not have understood it right, then they're calling into question whether or not they've understood it right in that verse that they're making their big stand on. You understand? So it has become, what happens is they've entrenched their position around what I perceive to be an improper grammatical understanding of this phrase and say it means this all the way through, when we've, I've just showed you that it does not, and it's not practical to say that. And so they have, in order for them to maintain the position that they've adopted, they have to remain consistent on this point. Because if they don't remain consistent on this point, then they're opening up the floodgates that they may not have understood it right. Yeah.
Back to Lee's comment earlier about the context. When I was a young Christian, I sat for a long time under a succession of bad teaching that was cultic. And I used to overcome that, I started to just read my Bible and memorizing things that I found interesting. And I used to say I learned the Bible in self-defense. But preachers will quote one verse. I mean, you do it too. Everybody does it.
Everybody does it.
And my practice for most of my life now has been, and I highly recommend it, look up those verses and read the context, because anybody can run amok with their own pet doctrine.
Anybody can do it. I can do it. Brother Jordan can do it. And that's Richard's statement. A text without a context is a pretext. Yes, he says that all the time. So you should be a Berean. Okay? You should not just believe me, some other preacher, or anybody just because they say it and go check out what's being said. And that to me seems to be like a principle. So let's sort of sum all this stuff up. I understand that I threw a lot of big words and technical jargon at you, okay? I hope that that not confuse you. I felt like I had to do that so that you guys would understand what's going on here as you think about this, okay? This is a somewhat complex issue. It's a technical issue, and you do have to pay attention to the details in order to really get an understanding of what's going on, okay? I think you can trust your English Bible. I think that you do need to pay attention to the grammar and all these sorts of things, as we've already mentioned. But what we need to do is we need to not adopt things that are so stringent that we can't take into account the individual occurrences of words and phrases and what they mean in a particular passage or context. So I hope all that makes sense. I appreciate you paying attention to this. I do hope that I am glad that we got this recorded and that I was kind of able to collect some of my thoughts on this and have some good interaction with you saints about it.
Where did you get it recorded?
It's an audio recording.
Yeah.
So we'll get the audio recording on the internet when Kurt gets back from his vacation. But does anybody have any questions, comments, or anything? Yeah, Wanda.
Can you take a snapshot of that and include it when you put that line in?
Yeah, I guess I could do that.
I
take a picture of that.
You forgot to tell us we were being recorded.
Yeah. You should assume that you're being recorded. If you're being recorded, you better behave. And you are. You better behave, Lee.
Just a comment. One of the things that threw me many years ago was even the Greek thing. If you assume that the Greek grammar does not change, it does. And the different teachers will throw you different curves too and make a certain grammar law and then change it. Bullinger was great for that. Sharpe-Grandville law, he changed that thing over and over again. And that always bothered me that if it was a law and that was the concrete, the foundation upon which we stand, they sometimes change it too.
Yeah. And we've already seen that in our study of Sonship Edification's teaching of Romans 8:17, because they'll say if children then heirs, and say that's a first class condition, this, and then they'll go down to if so be and say that's not a first class condition. Well, wait a minute here. If the first one is, then on what authority do you get to the next one and just say it's not, when it has the exact same structure as the first statement? It's an interpretation of convenience. That's what it is. Okay? But anyway, any other comments or questions? Appreciate your attention today. Next week we'll start the class on the Bible issue. Thanks for your attention.